From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, 251 mass shootings so far this year in our country. We talk with Congressman Andy Levin on what, if anything, Congress can do. Plus, the president blames shootings on violent video games. What does research tell us?
And that evidence is pointing to a pretty solid no on video games being the cause of real-life violence.
The late L. Brooks Patterson and his history with Detroit.
He wasn't a good neighbor to Detroit. I think that's a very fair way to put it.
Football season's at hand. What do parents need to know about brain injury in young athletes?
Our sports today are safer. So it's I think, a fallacy to compare what people are going through today as former professional athletes and take our kids and put that together.
Those stories and much, much more for you today on Stateside. Hello and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. On today's program, we talk with Detroit journalist Bill McGraw and explore the legacy of Oakland County Executive L. Brooks Patterson, who died on Saturday. But first, with the shootings in El Paso and Dayton over the weekend, we revisit as a nation the conversation about how to prevent future massacres. Congress has not agreed on how to curb gun violence over these past years, and now President Trump says he would favor background checks and would like to see them tied to comprehensive immigration reform. Here to talk about what Congress can and should do is Representative Andy Levin, a Democrat from Michigan's 9th District. Congressman, welcome.
Thanks so much for having me, Cynthia, under really horrifying circumstances.
Indeed. What a weekend for all of us. You know, the House, as we know, has passed gun control measures, but the Senate has yet to take them up. And it's worth pointing out Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell also filibustered a set of gun control measures while in the minority after the Sandy Hook massacre. Congressman, what is it going to take to make headway on these gun control measures?
I don't know, Cynthia, but you're right to focus on Mitch McConnell. He must call the Senate back into session and pass the sensible gun reform measures we already passed in the House and work with us to pass more so we can begin to get this epidemic of gun violence under control. It's just unacceptable that the Senate refuses to do anything.
And we know from what the president said today, he's suggesting tying background checks to immigration reform. What do you think of that?
One of the things that Mitch McConnell has told Nancy Pelosi repeatedly is that he does what the president wants. He needs to stop doing that because the president changes what he says he wants on a constant basis. Do you remember when he said earlier that he was for gun reform, then he met with the NRA, and in less than a couple hours, changed his mind? I'm glad to hear the president say he's willing to entertain these measures, but what our job is as the Congress is to pass laws, and then hopefully he will sign them. So the Senate needs to pass, our H.R. 8, which was our comprehensive background check law that we passed very, very early in the session, and then they need to take up the enhanced background check bill we passed, H.R. 1112, which closed what's known as the Charleston loophole so that the authorities have time to carry out background checks. We will, in the House, we will also pass an assault weapons ban. We will pass red flag laws, and we will look for the Senate and the president to work with us to get those enacted as well.
And the president said today he wants red flag laws. So is this something that could be a point of agreement on?
I hope so. I mean, here we have a president who has constantly engaged in rhetoric, attacking immigrants, calling them an invasion, other dehumanizing language about immigrants and people of color. And then you have a gunman in El Paso use precisely those words as he's mowing down innocent Americans. I mean, maybe the president is sort of being shamed into changing his tune. We'll take it, whatever it is, Cynthia. Mm-hmm. We just want to solve the problem of innocent Americans being killed. People in Texas, I believe, were from the ages of 2 to 82 who were killed. You know, in all three cases of the mass shootings, they used high-capacity magazines. Nobody needs those, up to 100 rounds. In one magazine. So we need to cut the size of magazines that are allowed. one of the shooters, the one in Dayton, I believe, used the kind of ammunition that pierces the armored vest that police wear. I mean, so there's no reason that someone not in a job where they have to kill a lot of people quickly, like our military, should have these kinds of weapons for civilian life. And shame on us that we aren't restricting them, because the American people want us to do so.
But as we have that conversation, you and I know, Congressman, there are people out there who are very worried about their Second Amendment rights. So how do we balance those rights with the demand to end these shootings?
No problem. Nobody's going after anybody's Second Amendment rights here. Even Justice Scalia, when he wrote the opinion changing the way we view the Second Amendment, said that reasonable restrictions on guns are part of that deal. And all we wanted, nobody's taken away anybody's hunting rifle or taken away anybody's handgun to protect themselves at their house. We just want to do what virtually every other country in the world does, which is have sensible restrictions so we don't have this kind of slaughter in our streets. And Cynthia, let me just say that this isn't just about mass shootings. This weekend in Chicago, we had 47 people injured and 7 people killed in gun violence. That wasn't a mass shooting. And that's happening every day in this country. In Michigan, there's someone killed with a gun every 8 hours, and you know something like 1,100 to 1,200 people will die of gun violence in our state this year. It's a public health crisis, and we need to do whatever we can to reduce this you know horrible slaughter. And you know, you're a parent, I'm a parent. I mean, how can we imagine our kid at a mall shopping and being taken from us? Or our sibling. It's just horrifying. And I'm telling you, the Democrats in the House, in any event, now that we control the House, we are passing this legislation. We will continue to pass this legislation. And all that we can do as Americans is demand that the United States Senate join us and pass legislation and send it to the president. And I do hope he'll sign it.
Congressman Andy Levin, thanks for your time.
Thank you so much, Cynthia. It's great to be with you.
And as members of Congress wrestle with how to respond to these latest shootings and what to do to keep them from happening, Republican leaders are pointing a finger at violent video games. Here's President Trump from a press conference earlier today.
We must stop the glorification of violence in our society. This includes the gruesome and grisly video games that are now commonplace. It is too easy today for troubled youth to surround themselves with a culture that celebrates violence.
And with us now is Whitney DeCamp, who's a professor of sociology at Western Michigan University. He researches the connection between violence and video games. Whitney, what do you make of this argument? We should look at violent video games if we want to do something about mass shootings in this country.
Well, as someone who studies them, I certainly agree that it's an area worth looking at, but I think those comments ignore the fact that we already have a lot of evidence on this topic. And that evidence is pointing to a pretty solid no on video games being the cause of real life violence. There have been some studies that have shown possibly some connection with small increases in aggression, but the bulk of the evidence shows that video games are not causing people to engage in violence. And we have other issues that can more easily explain why people are engaging in violence.
And what might those be? What has your research told you?
Well, my own research has found that when you compare the effects from violent media to other things in people's lives, the blame seems to lie more with their social environment. If they are seeing or hearing violence in their own home between members of their family, that's going to increase the chances that they grow up to engage in violence, as well as, you know, if youth are seeing violence in their own neighborhood, that's potentially going to impact them as well. Seeing real violence matters a great deal more than simulated violence in a video game.
So what do you think, Whitney, would be a more effective focus for our elected leaders instead of pointing to violent video games if they really want to address the root causes of what would compel someone to commit a mass shooting? What would be a more effective focus?
Well, it's hard to define one particular focus because in the field of criminology, where we focus on the causes of crime, we've identified many different explanations for why people engage in violence. But I'd say some of them are, you know, try and improve social conditions being one of them. People who are better educated, people who live in safe environments where they feel loved and welcomed, tend to be less likely to engage in violence. That's a great goal to have, but in terms of actually getting there, it's very difficult to come up with a concrete plan of action for how we're going to get there. On the other hand, there are other things that we know are connected to this as well. In a lot of these mass shootings, we're seeing people using semi-automatic assault rifles. And if we're going to try and make a connection between a particular shooting and something in that person's life, that's one that's fairly consistent and something that we should be looking very closely at. Also, that hateful rhetoric that's being directed at people does seem to be a motivating factor for some people. Several of the recent mass shootings, we've seen the shooters really making it clear that they're motivated by a racial or ethnic basis to direct hate towards certain groups. And so if we can try and reduce the prevalence of that, particularly among our leaders, that, I think, would have a potential for making an impact as well.
Whitney, when you hear politicians like President Trump or House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy point the finger of blame at violent video games, what do you feel?
Well, I can tell you what I feel. I want to preface this with saying that, you know, I don't know what's going on in their mind. But what I feel, what my interpretation of that is that they're looking for a scapegoat. They're looking for something that they can blame that is easier to address than the real causes are. It's very easy for someone to blame video games because it's not something that requires a lot of people to change. They can talk about this. We know based on Supreme Court history that video games are protected free speech, so there's not really a whole lot that can be done about that short of passing a constitutional amendment. So nothing's going to happen. But it's a convenient way to change the discussion away from other issues that might be more controversial and harder to deal with, like the issue of gun availability, mental health, and hateful rhetoric that's out there.
Whitney DeCamp, professor of sociology at Western Michigan University. Thanks for being with us.
Happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
Coming up, we will meet an archivist at the Walter Reuther Library in Detroit, being honored for his work preserving the history of the American labor movement. That is next on Stateside. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. We pretty much understand library collections hold the depth and breadth of our experiences. Our past informs our present and then directs us toward our future. But have you ever stopped to think about just how these important pieces of our past are gathered and preserved? Well, it happens thanks to the hard work of people like Lewis Jones. Dr. Jones is the field archivist for the Walter Reuther Library at Wayne State University in Detroit. He documents the American labor movement, the civil rights struggle, and the history of metropolitan Detroit. And he's being recognized and honored as a fellow of the Society of American Archivists. It's one of the profession's highest honors. Lewis Jones, welcome.
Yeah, thank you, Cynthia. It was great to be here.
So to anybody who wonders what you can do with a degree in history, here you are, Exhibit A, years of study capped off by your PhD in American history from Wayne State. And now you're getting this very, very high honor for your work as a field archivist. So congratulations.
Yes. Yeah, thank you very much.
What is a field archivist?
Oh, boy, good question. Let me just back up just a little bit and explain what an archivist is. We collect, we preserve, and we provide access to documentary heritage. And so we do that for organizations, for people, for state, local, and federal government. And archivists are located in hospitals, in universities, in corporations, religious institutions. And so when I say collect, preserve, and provide access to documentary heritage, I'm talking about people and organizations, largely. And like I said before, local, state, and federal governments. We're talking about press releases, correspondences, you know, a whole range of audiovisual material, might be lecture notes, whole range of what we call primary sources. And this is the basis of a lot of the history that you'll see written. You'll see documentaries that make use of archives. You'll see exhibits and museums that make use of archives. Journalists occasionally make use of archives as well. And as a field archivist, though, it's my job to convince people to give us their stuff. Mm. So my particular job at Wayne State University at the Walter P. Reuther Library, I collect the records of people and organizations connected with the historical development of metropolitan Detroit. And I'll do a little bit of that with Wayne State University, although we have a university archivist that does most of that. And records and papers of organizations and of people connected with organized labor. And that's actually what we're known for more than anything else. But we have a pretty large collecting scope that covers metropolitan Detroit.
And what brought you to be focusing on the labor movement and the kind of work that you're doing for the Reuther?
Right. That's been the collection scope of the archives at Wayne State, really not since its inception. The founding director of the archives, a guy by the name of Phil Mason, came on board in 1958, and he was the university archivist at that time and collected a lot of material around the university, nurturing relationships with administrators and secretaries and other folks that had records in their possession on campus, and brought many of those records back that weren't being used for the current purposes, brought them back to the archives. And it was in pretty Kresge Library at the time. But even as he was walking in the door, he had it in his mind that he wanted to develop a labor archives. And so he started nurturing relationships with the International Executive Board of the UAW and with Walter Reuther himself, and convinced the UAW that Wayne State University should be the home for their official historical records. And that took place in 1962. Subsequent to then, he began nurturing relationships with other folks in the organized labor, including Cesar Chavez. And we have the records of the United Farm Workers. That's Cesar Chavez was the longtime president of the organization. So many others. The Industrial Workers of the World, which is a very radical organization of the early 20th century, still exists, but not what it was in the early 20th century. The government chased it out of existence to a large extent.
Well, what I'd like to do is, I was going over, you have a mind-boggling 9-page CV, including this stunning list of collections that you've helped to bring into the Reuther. As I look through, you know, we're talking names like Damon Keith and Wade McCree and Tony Spina, the Detroit Free Press photojournalist, the Detroit Symphony Orchestra, Sonny Elliott, any Detroiter who grew up watching him on TV, the beloved weatherman, the Detroit branch of the NAACP, so many. So out of this rather stellar list, I'm wondering, what are some of your personal highlights? You know, people that you've sat down with, and stories and artifacts that you just could not believe you were part of.
One of them is a name that you didn't mention and that you probably won't hear much about on other occasions. But I got a very interesting phone call two or three years ago from a woman who had a collection of material that her grandfather had kept. Her grandfather was a guy by the name of William Gurney. Here in Detroit, and he was hired by a corporation. I forgot exactly which one now. This would have been in the 30s and the 40s. He was hired by a corporation to infiltrate the Communist Party here in Detroit. And we've heard plenty of stories about how folks have infiltrated the Communist Party and organized labor for that matter too, but not the records that kind of go into some detail about what they did and how they went about doing
it. Yeah,
the nuts and bolts of it. And he had a biography that he wrote, about 40 pages, about 7 pages of which are missing for reasons we're not sure clear about. But in this biography and other records within his collection, he documents how he infiltrated the Communist Party in Detroit and actively sought to wreak havoc within the organization.
And also monitored activists working for Ford Motor Company in the 1940s.
Exactly. Wow. As a matter of fact, he worked for Harry Bennett.
Yes. So,
a name that some of your listeners may be aware of.
Certainly.
But he was in charge of the security, to put it mildly, for Ford Motor Company. And had, you know, literally like a goon squad, folks that ex-cons and other folks that would beat up and harass UAW and other folks that were perceived to be activists who worked at Ford Motor Company.
Somebody who is not necessarily known not like a name like Leonard Woodcock or Wade McCree or that, but somebody who had an integral part of labor history in Detroit.
Absolutely, absolutely.
You know, I as you build this collection, I'm wondering, as you're acquiring things, you're talking with people, you're talking them into giving up their documents,
right.
their photos. Are you thinking at that time of the historians of the future?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, one of the joys of the field for me, and I think I speak for a number of my colleagues too, is not only getting the material, which is important in of and of itself, but having people walk into our reading room and order request boxes from our stack area and actually make use of the material. And you find this material wind up in books, in articles, in exhibits that are in museums and in documentaries as well. And that's really, you know, the joy I get out of the field, not just collecting it, as important as that is, but seeing it used not just by historians, but all kinds of people make use of the material. Genealogists, I think I mentioned journalists before, a whole range of other kind of people, people working on their dissertations and master's thesis and students that are working on their bachelor's degrees. Their professors often have them come into the archives, want to give them a sense of what's involved in working with what we call primary sources.
I'm speaking with Dr. Lewis Jones, who's the field archivist for the Labor and Urban Affairs Archives at Walter P. Reuther Library at Wayne State, who will soon be honored as a fellow of the American Society of American Archivists, which is the highest honor the SAA can bestow. What kinds of changes have you seen, Lewis, through the years? You've been archivist since 1993, so you've crossed into the digital age.
Yes, and actually that's really the basis of some of the changes, too. When I first came to Wayne State University, there would be consecutive days where there would be literally nobody in our reading room. The lights would be off. It'd be dark in the reading room. And we still get a good deal of reference work that we'd have to provide folks over the phone. But there was no internet then. That was crazy talk. But over the years, obviously, that's changed incredibly. Whereas it used to be a time where people knew about us because they read a book and they saw a footnote in a book that made reference to some material that they were interested in, and they gave us a call to find out what other kind of material that we may have that might support their research interests. It wasn't until the internet exploded that began to change. So our guides to our collections now are all online. And whether people live across the street or, you know, on the other side of the planet, they can find out what's in our collections, what's in each one of our collections. And so when they walk in the door now, and they walk in far larger numbers now than they did when I first came on board. As a matter of fact, there's rarely a shift. We have two-hour shifts on the reading room desk. There's rarely a shift where there's not a researcher in the reading room, and oftentimes many researchers. And so,
and that must warm your heart.
It does. I mean, it keeps us busy, but, you know, that's what you get paid for. And it also means that a whole range of literature, of documentaries, of exhibits, a whole range of projects are able to be pursued because people are walking the door, because of the internet and the digital age that they just made reference to.
What are the keys to being a good archivist to preserve our own history? How can we best do what you're doing in our own lives with our own families?
Oh, boy, that's a very good question. We'll hold on to material, for one. Many times people just throw material away. But material, for a whole range of reasons, can be very important. You yourself may not be interested in the material, but I'm willing to bet within every family there's somebody, the mother, the father, the kids, the nephew, somebody that's going to be interested in that material. So I encourage people to hang on to it. And this material can be photographs, yearbooks, letters that you've written or that you've received. It's just a really great idea to hold on to it and to pass it down, if not to an archive like the one where I work, then to another family member that may have use for it because their child or they themselves will be interested in it, and trying to explain who they are, you know, who their family is, where they came from, you know, what their identities are all about. And a lot of that is all wrapped up into these records that people have, but they oftentimes throw them away.
In fact, I will tell you, of amongst my circle of friends, people who are, you know, baby boomers who nearing a certain age, the big question is, do we hang on to the love letters and let the kids find them when we're gone?
You're right. Good question. Yeah, it could be a dangerous thing too, like to hang on to records like that. But if they're stored away privately in the appropriate kind of way, I think even those could be valuable. Although we all understand if there might be some reasons why you would not want to do that.
What is at stake in the work you do, Lewis?
Well, if there are not people like me, if there are not institutions like where I work, then the things that we know won't be known. It's really kind of as simple as that. You know, the books that we read, they're not all based on research that are done at our archives, but many of them are. The documentaries that we look at, I mean, there are very few documentaries that you look at because documentaries are almost inherently historical in some manner, shape, or form. But the overwhelming majority of them are in part, at least, based on research done at places where I work. It's the memory of institutions, of cities, of countries, of the human experience. It's our memory, and without them, we would not know what we know. I often think about the things that I remember, and they're often, well, not often, but occasionally, they're in conflict with things that have been written. And so sometimes I'll reflect on something and I'll be clear in my mind that it happened in a certain time and in a certain place. And I'll look back at a letter that I wrote and said, nope, that's not exactly the case. But that record won't change. It doesn't necessarily tell the truth because all records are biased in some manner, shape, or form. But a record is a record and they don't change. In the digital era, we have to be particularly concerned about these things because they can change a digital record. But we're talking about hard copy records. They are what they are. They might be interpreted differently today than they were 50 years ago or 50 years from now, but they do not change. And so the memories of our families, of our institutions, of our cities, and all of that is wrapped up in these records in large respect.
Dr. Lewis Jones, field archivist for the Walter P. Reuther Library at Wayne State University, and congratulations on your upcoming honor from the Society of American Archivists.
Thank you.
As Michigan State Parks celebrate a big 100th birthday, we're looking at these parks through the eyes of the people who work there. Today, North Higgins Lake State Park, northwest of Roscommon in Crawford County, where Josh Pello is park manager. Josh, tell us what you're seeing today at North Higgins Lake State Park.
We are experiencing about 85 degrees, blue sky, and Higgins Lake, which is a spring-fed lake, is crystal clear, like Caribbean style, at this moment right now.
Well, we're jealous. That sounds exquisite. What do you think sets this park, North Higgins Lake, apart from the others? What's so special about it?
Not only I'm seeing Higgins Lake itself, once again, 11th largest inland lake in Michigan, spring-fed lake. Like I said, it's like Caribbean out there, especially today. I think the lake frontage that we have, the amount of campsites, the historical factor that we have dealing with the historic Higgins Lake Nursery and the CCC Museum. So we got a mixture of recreational plus a mixture of history and camping and trails. We got a lot to offer in our land.
And take us back to a bit of that history. How did this 449 acres become a state park?
Well, the area started in like 1903, and a guy by the name of Philip Roth started experimenting with like a 3-acre nursery. In 1909, the state actually took over that nursery and it became a state-run nursery. And then a few years later, in 1925, across the road from where the nursery is at on Higgins Lake, the state actually established what we now refer to as State Forest Campground. So it was a rustic campground where people could set up their tents and their small RVs that they had back in 1925, right on the shoreline of Higgins Lake.
So there's a long and honored history of Michiganders setting up those campgrounds and enjoying it. I'm just curious, because it was a nursery, is there any plant life that might not be found elsewhere?
Right now, we're actually hoping to try to make it back into like some type of nursery. But going into the campgrounds, Our campground is separated into like an east loop and a west loop. Our east loop is actually where like the old nursery manager had his house. And so when you're in our east campground, you actually see some non-native trees to the area, where tulip poplars, a European larch. So it's not just the normal oaks and maples and pines that you see in our area. There is a little bit of a wide variety of different tree species that are still growing from when that manager actually lived inside the park.
Josh, what is your, first of all, how long have you been at the park?
I've been manager since 2015, but I have actually worked at North Higgins Lake State Park four different times since 2005. So many times over the last 14 years.
What's your favorite memory?
My favorite memory would have to be, there's two of them, and it actually goes back to more like customer related. There was young child with his grandpa and grandma, and riding a bike on training wheels. And literally, I think it was last year, they came back for the first time in so long, and now that kid's like driving a car.
Oh.
And like I made a memorable experience for him, but it's like watching that generation, go older. From when I remember him on a tricycle or a bicycle with training wheels to now the guy's driving grandma and grandpa into the park. Second thing also deals with other campers. People come year after year after year. A few years back, one of those people, when they were graduating high school, I got an open house invitation in the mail at the park, inviting me to their open house because obviously I did something that lasted a memory for them that they wanted me to come to their high school graduation.
So it kind of feels like the North Higgins Lake State Park family.
I would have to say yes. We're kind of like a family, yes.
Josh Pello is the park manager of North Higgins Lake State Park. Thank you so much for sharing your park with us, Josh.
Hey, thank you.
Coming up, football season is right around the corner, which renews the debate over dangers of the sport. We'll talk about the threat concussions could pose to young athletes.
Our sports today are safer, so it's I think, a fallacy to compare what people are going through today as former professional athletes and take our kids and put that together.
That is next on Stateside. Welcome back. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Well, football returns this week. The NFL preseason games kick in Thursday. College and high school teams are busy practicing for their upcoming seasons. And that means it's time for new attention to the safety issues, particularly concussion and CTE, chronic traumatic encephalopathy. What should parents and players know about these brain injuries and the safety protocols that they should expect from coaches and from trainers? Michigan Radio Sports commentator John Eubacon explores these questions in his new book, Overtime. He's here now along with Dr. Jeffrey Kutcher, who runs the Sports Neurology Clinic in Brighton. He directs the NBA's concussion programs along with advising the Olympics, the player associations of the NFL, the NHL, and in the past, Michigan football. Great to have you both here and a good time to talk about this.
Absolutely. And also, by the way, Dr. Kutcher is also an author.
Yes, he's got it as well.
He's got his own book on this very topic. So,
John, in your book, you state football has two big problems when it comes to safety and injuries. What are those two big problems?
The first one is safety and injuries. Second one is the perception of safety and injuries, and these are not necessarily the same things. So even as the game gets safer and safer, which Dr. Kutcher, I believe, will speak to, there are always inherent risks in this sport, and there are always going to be, I think. But they've greatly reduced it, but that only matters so much. It only matters if the parents see it that way and allow their kids to play football. Otherwise, the sport will dry up, even though it is getting safer. And they've done a very good job in the first problem, which is reducing the risk, and I think a very poor job in the second problem, which is educating the public.
Okay. And when you think about concussions, they've certainly become a hot-button topic, which was not always the case. People used to be, there'd be jokes about you got his bell rung and walk it off. Dr. Kutcher, break down what happens in a concussion.
Sure thing, Cynthia. So concussion is a type of brain injury that occurs when the brain experiences force. It is an electrical injury. It is a physiological state. It is not a physical injury. One of the big problems we have in this area is the word concussion is misused, probably more often than it's used appropriately. Concussion is a transient physiological state.
Okay, it's temporary. But then what happens if there's one concussion after another and it becomes cumulative?
So that gets into the concept of repetitive hits, not concussions. And that's an important distinction. It's the repetitive hits over time, whether you've been concussed or not, that may lead to something like CTE. So really they exist on two different planes altogether.
All right. And then CTE, tell us what that is. And I know it's hard to, it really can't be diagnosed until postmortem, right?
Well, so that's another area where this term is misused quite often. So CTE is best described as a pathological finding at autopsy. Okay, so for that reason, I can't diagnose that until somebody has passed and we're doing an autopsy. That being said, CTE does not refer to the things that are going on in a person's life while they're living. So somebody can have memory problems, mood problems, personality issues, sleep issues.
Early dementia,
exactly. These things can occur while they're alive. I can diagnose that as a physician as being related to trauma. Mm. I can't confirm that with CTE descriptive pathology, right? But I can say, look, given all variables that are going on in this person's life, it does appear that their exposure to repetitive hits over time did play a role. And the last thing I'll say is that CTE is not the only negative outcome from repetitive hits.
So this is, it's hard to be cut and dried about this.
Absolutely.
But let's say I'm a mom, or you're a dad, John. You're a dad of a little boy. Let's roll ahead a few years. He's a high schooler. He wants to try out for the football team. And you go online and you do a little research, and it doesn't take much. There's a staggering list of NFL players with CTE confirmed postmortem, an even more staggering list of NFL players who have sued the NFL for concussion-related injuries. You think of the very, very tragic and violent life of Aaron Hernandez of the New England Patriots, who, you know, had a very stormy life, went to prison for murdering a friend, died by suicide, and the autopsy found he had severe CTE. I find this with three mouse clicks. What do I think about having my kid play football?
It is a great question. It is one I actually ask in the book Overtime, which comes out September 3rd, cheap plug. We asked ourselves, Teddy was 3 years old last year and the season started, now he's almost four. And the question is, okay, if Teddy wanted to play and he's also bigger and faster than his dad, would we let him? And when we started the research last year, my wife and I on this subject, we were not sure. I mean, because no matter what the stats are and so on, that's your kid. And yet, once I talked to Michigan's doctors, Michigan's trainers, like Dr. Kutcher previously, previous Michigan doctor, and saw the protocols they go through and what these players gain from playing football. If you're not going to gain anything, why risk anything? The answer was, ultimately, if he's playing for the right coach and the right program with the right protocols, then yes, we would. And the reason is basically sanity. The caution level these days is so great at Michigan that last year, the three biggest injuries on the team, one player ruptured a pectoral muscle wrestling in his apartment, another would suffer a moped accident, and a third would trip and fall while helping his parents move and break his ankle. Those are the three biggest injuries last year in Michigan football. Now, that clearly changes year to year.
Sure.
But it is much safer than it used to be.
But by the time somebody gets to the level of being able to put on the maize and blue or the green and white and play at that Division I college level, there's a lot of years of middle school, elementary school, high school. Dr. Kutcher, what should a parent expect, especially when you're new to this, when you don't know what to expect? What is a good concussion protocol, and can we be confident these schools are following them?
Sure thing. So two quick points. One, regarding this idea that three clicks got you to all these stories and cases and all the bad press. That reflects John's first point about there being sort of this perception of injury and risk and then the actual medical reality. There's a difference between the media and medicine.
Alas. Okay?
So the first thing is...
The list of players who are suing the NFL, that's not media. There it is.
It's, correct. Yes. But... medically, there are studies that show that the vast majority of NFL players are fine. And I'm talking like over two-thirds easily are fine. We can't make a movie about the guy who's the CEO of a company, right? That's not a good story. That's not the story that's going to sell books and
Jim Hackett at Ford Motor Company, former Michigan football player.
That's thing one is the perception, and the medicine is different. Thing two, getting back to another point, is it's safer today than it was when these folks played. So when I'm a parent, and I'm a parent as well, when I'm thinking about my kids playing sports, I look at the sports we play today. I grew up playing hockey in Detroit. You know, much safer today than it was then, football as well. Our sports today are safer. So it's I think, a fallacy to compare what people are going through today as former professional athletes and take our kids and put that together. A good concussion protocol is not a protocol. It's a process. If you over-protocol something, if you say, hey, I'm going to treat every single player that comes off with a headache the same way, you're going to get that wrong more often than not. So our approach, what we preach all the time, is we want to have the right people in place to be able to recognize injury, because our job when we're on the sidelines of football games or at the bottom of a ski race, my job is not to diagnose concussion. My job is to triage for safety. However, once that episode is over and you're taking time to get the diagnosis right, there are many more things that will cause a headache than a concussion in an athlete. So if we take every headache and say that's a concussion, the athletes will not want to tell people they have a headache.
So, and by the way, it should be noted too that the state of Michigan recently passed a law a few months ago that you can only practice with hitting from 90 minutes now down to 30 minutes per week. So this is your point. And this is why I think we're seeing, sadly, the most injured generation we're seeing now in their 60s and 70s. Mm-hmm. But like you said earlier, if you're a parent, you can't wait 50 years for the science. You got to make your decision now.
So I guess bottom line, what do you say, Dr. Kutcher, to these parents, especially the new ones who are seeing their youngster, their middle school or their high school kid going out for the first time for a team?
Well, I think the most important question, first one, is why are you playing this sport? And that's sometimes lost in the conversation. They're doing it because their father did it, their mother did it, or their friends are doing it. You want it to be a benefit to that child, first off. Then it comes down to the coaching, I think. That's the next most important step is, do you know the coach? How well do you know the coach? Do you get a sense that they have sort of up-to-date practice techniques, response to injury? Is there an athletic trainer available not only during games but practices? What is in place if a concussion is suspected, right? And then how do we deal with that when it is diagnosed? If those things are in place, I feel our sports can be safe to play. If any of those are missing, then you should probably rethink the decision.
And John, to parents who will say, no way do I want my kid playing football.
I would say two things. One, risks are relative. But so is sitting around playing Xbox all day long. You gain things from playing football. You do not gain sitting on the couch playing Xbox. That must be said. Second of all, I'll go back to Grant Newsom, who had a pretty bad knee injury, knocked his career out, All-American would be, and now he's getting his master's at the Ford School. You ask any of the parents of Michigan football players, you know, would you tell other parents to play, have their kids play football? They all say the same thing. It depends. Depends on the coaches in place, the trainers, and what you plan to get out of it. Overall, it's a lot safer and better experience than it's currently advertised.
John U. Bacon, whose latest book is Overtime, Jim Harbaugh and the Michigan Wolverines at the Crossroads of College Football. We'll be talking about that coming up in a few weeks. And Dr. Jeffrey Kutcher, who runs the Sports Neurology Clinic in Brighton. Thank you so much to both of you.
Thank you.
You're very welcome.
There will be a public viewing, visitation, and funeral this week for longtime Oakland County executive L. Brooks Patterson. The 80-year-old Patterson died over the weekend, just a few months after announcing he had pancreatic cancer. Many colleagues and some in the media are praising Patterson for the way he ran Oakland County's government and his crusty, blunt way of putting things. Others point to Patterson's decades of criticizing Detroit and its leaders. Bill McGraw has been a journalist in Detroit for 45 years. He is a co-founder of Deadline Detroit, where he published an opinion piece about Patterson's mixed record. Bill, his friends and supporters say Brooks Patterson loved Detroit. That word is used. He was a newsmaker since 1970. Do his words and actions support that?
I'm afraid they don't. It's unfortunate the discussion has to go in that direction, I think, so shortly after his death. But he had such an unusual career, being a public figure for 50 years, almost 50 years. But as I wrote, the record supports a lot of what Patterson's friends are saying about him. His administration of Oakland County is beyond question. But he wasn't a good neighbor to Detroit. I think that's a very fair way to put it.
And what are some of the statements and sentiments that Patterson made about Detroit through the years that really jump out in your mind?
Well, probably the one that stuck out in my mind is from like 1990, so it goes back that far. He was still the Oakland County prosecutor at the time, and he was interviewed by Zev Chaffetz, who did a book that was very well known at that time and somewhat controversial, Devil's Night. And he asked Patterson a lot of questions about Detroit, and here's one that one response Patterson had. Quote, "In no sense are we dependent on Detroit. They are dependent on us. The truth is, Detroit has had its day. I don't give a damn about Detroit. It has no direct bearing on the quality of my life. If I never crossed 8 Mile again, I wouldn't be bereft of anything." So that was one that sort of lays down his, I think, candid thinking about Detroit at the time. And I think another one isn't so much as a quote, but I kind of remembered it, and I went back and found it in the Free Press Archives, a story about it. In 93, there was a very crucial race for Detroit mayor going on to replace Coleman Young, who had retired, was retiring. And the two candidates were Dennis Archer and Sharon McPhail. McPhail was going around saying that Patterson had endorsed Archer, her opponent. And, of course, that was not true. And if it had been true, that would have been the kiss of death for Archer. So Patterson, rather than just saying, don't quote me saying something I didn't say, put together a show where he, and it was basically white guys pretending they were Sharon McPhail and Coleman Young and whatever, and making fun of them. And Hugh McDermott wrote about it in the Free Press, and he called what went on that night. It wasn't outright racial in the sense that there were no slurs uttered, but as McDermott called it, racial mischief. And he said if something like that had been staged in Detroit, it would have caused a riot.
And we know even more recently, was it in 2018, that Patterson joked he'd rather join the KKK than work with the Detroit Business Group, although, as you note in your piece, he later apologized for that.
Right. But, you know, that was an interesting thing he said. Of course, the group he's talking about was Dan Gilbert and some other people who, when Detroit started, at least, you know, the sections of Detroit that are turning around, when that all started happening 10, 12 years ago, the very beginnings of it, Patterson wasn't quite sure how to handle that. And so he kind of struck out in some odd ways about, you know, Oakland County is in pretty good shape, and losing a couple businesses probably isn't going to hurt it as much as gaining a couple businesses will help Detroit.
And certainly we've seen him. He opposed, you know, the transportation, regional transportation initiatives, as well as others. And I'm wondering, Bill, as you've covered news, you've covered Patterson through the years as a journalist in Detroit. What have you been thinking as you have heard and read reactions, especially from other journalists, to Brooks Patterson's death? I've kind of seen a pretty strong streak of, you know, oh, that Brooks, he liked to stir things up. He was outspoken, you know, kind of like a cranky rapscallion of an old uncle.
And he was that. And as I wrote, he was a very, very unusual politician. Most politicians try and be very decorous, and also, you know, they don't like to be around reporters. Well, Patterson, as most people know, even who didn't cover him, who just have watched him for the last 40 years, liked to be the life of the party. And he also really liked to hang around with reporters and was very engaging with them. So he made a lot of friendships over the years. You said I covered Patterson. I covered issues he was involved with,
right,
but I never really covered him and really only met him once. So my view of him is what he said over the years and what you can go back and look at, what he said and what he has done.
And as you say, you look at his at the record and the things that were said. It's certainly, as you point out, you say he seemed to take as much glee in Detroit's decline as in Oakland County's rise, because there are his associates will say, look, his number one priority was Oakland County and making it strong, and he did that well.
Of course, and you know, then that is inarguable. He definitely made Oakland County his priority, and as everyone, even national observers who don't really have a dog in the fight here, say that he ran Oakland County in extremely well. But I think just as far as looking at a neighbor in the way neighbors and cities behave, Patterson was the leader. He was in essence kind of the mayor of suburbia, because there's no other politician outside of Detroit who kind of commands the publicity and whatever that Patterson could, or that the Oakland County executive, whoever the next one will be, will command. And so I think it's fair to say that being the executive of Oakland County, and given how well Oakland County's done, you know, why couldn't he have just taken it easy on Detroit a little bit? If he didn't want to be someone who was seen as being an ally of the Detroit mayors, couldn't he have just cut it on the rhetoric a little bit? And, you know, when you go back to the New Yorker article, the profile of him that was controversial in 2014, the whole headline there was Drop Dead Detroit, which is sort of, that summed up his attitude, according to the magazine.
What will Brooks Patterson's legacy be?
That's a really good question. Unquestionably, it will be that he ran Oakland County well. And now I think it's fair to say, too, that running a county that's growing and growing and growing is harder than running a city that was declining and declining over the years. But nonetheless, he's done what national experts say was a really good job. As far as his relationship with Detroit, you know, and of course, given the fact that, especially in his earlier days, Oakland County was really white, and of course, Detroit is the blackest big city in America. So there was a racial element in there. My story does not say Brooks Patterson was a racist, but it points out that he put himself in an area where critics could accuse him of that. And that's unfortunate that he did that, because I think it is going to sully his reputation over the long run.
Longtime Detroit journalist Bill McGraw. As always, Bill, thanks so much.
Thank you, Cindy.
And join us tomorrow on Stateside. We'll talk with the Flint Community Schools superintendent about the district's big change away from the traditional summer break to what's called a balanced calendar with shorter breaks spread through the year.
The school system is the locus whereby they can get enrichment when they need it. And so the goal really is for us in the city of Flint to make sure that our kids actually have productive time and that we actually cultivate that time for their growth and development. And I wish that many more school districts in the state of Michigan would also do the same.
That will be tomorrow on Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so very much for listening.